verses 1 through 5 of Revelation 21, and here we go. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. And he that sat upon the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he said unto me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. All right, now we'll make our timeline again, because I found that people are not clear at all on the chronology of the events, or the sequence of the events, I should say. The sequence of the events, just like we had this morning, this is the cross of the Lord and his resurrection and his ascension. And then this line segment here at the left of the line is the church age. And we're probably right in here, almost at the coming of the Lord. Right about in here. Almost at his coming. The time when the church, when the royal priesthood will be raised and ascend to meet the Lord. And we talked about this morning the greatest revival, the revival that God has prepared. And Jesus shall rule for 1,000 years on the throne of David in Jerusalem. And we'll call this the kingdom age. And then there'll be a great white throne here at which the dead shall be judged. And then if they're lost, they'll go into the lake of fire. And if they are saved, they will gain access to the New Jerusalem, which will come down here, the city that lies four square. I don't know what it looks like. A great cube with a wall around it here. With gates in it, however it looks. This holy city that comes down. And then life begins here. They say life begins at 40. Life doesn't begin at 40. Life begins when the New Jerusalem comes down. And all of these things here are preparatory for the reign of Jesus over the world, over the creation of God. Now, something else happens right here. What is it? Is it just before this great white throne, what is it that happens? Well, yeah, Satan is released and fire comes down from God out of heaven. Fire comes down and destroys the nation. There's no battle here. The nations rebel. What are they called? Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog. Armageddon is over here. This is Armageddon. This is when the Lord returns with his saints. And this is close at hand. This is not far away. This is a battle when the peoples of the earth fight against the Lord, and he comes down, and there's a great slaughter, and the wicked are crushed out of the earth. Then the Lord takes his place on the throne of David in Jerusalem, right in here. Then there's 1,000 years of his rule. At the end of this time, Satan is let out of the bottomless pit. He's put in the bottomless pit here. He's let out of the bottomless pit. He goes out to deceive the nations, Gog and Magog. They come up against the camp of the saints in Jerusalem. Fire comes down from God out of heaven and destroys them. And then what happens? You know, I've preached for years thinking that everybody understood this clearly. And I'm finding out that most people don't. They don't know where Armageddon is. They don't have any concept of what's going on here. They talk about heaven. They don't know what relationship this has to heaven or anything else. So I figured I better start explaining it. Yes, the general resurrection takes place here, but there's something that happens right in here that is very important. That happens at the White Throne Judgment. Hades and death and Satan are cast into the lake of fire. But what happens before then? After fire comes down and destroys Gog and Magog, what happens? The heaven and earth pass away, and that is in Revelation chapter 20. It says, oh, wait a second. Find it here. I know it's in here. Verse 11. And I saw a great white throne, Revelation 20:11, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was no place found for them. Now, I've labored with this thing and written about it, and I couldn't make up my mind whether that was talking about the spiritual heaven or the space. When it says heaven and earth shall pass away, and then in Revelation 21, it says a new heaven. Now, why is it that we cannot tell whether that's talking about the space that we know or the spiritual heaven where God is? Why is it that we cannot tell? It's the same word. There's you can't tell from the Greek language because it only has one word for heaven. And this is true also in the Hebrew. Now in the beginning, it says God created the heaven and the earth. All right, then it says he had the earth, he gathered together the waters, he put a division between the waters so that there was waters under the firmament and waters over the firmament. And what did he call a firmament? Heaven. And it says he put the sun, moon, and stars in the firmament of heaven. So space is heaven. So when Jesus said, "Our Father who art in heaven," is he talking about the firmament, or what is he talking about? That's why it's so confusing. You cannot tell what he's telling about. So I talked about, in one of the early books I wrote on Revelation 21:22, I said that the Lord would do away with the spiritual realm and the natural realm, everything, and start all over again. But I've come to the conclusion that what the Lord is talking about here is, as translated in the New American Standard, I saw a new sky. Not heaven where God is. He's not going to make a new heaven where God is. He's going to make a new sky. So in verse 11, where it says, the earth and the heaven fled away, it means the earth and the sky fled away, and not the spiritual heaven. I've come to that conclusion. And it's kind of interesting to me. And when I was talking up at Jerry Wish's funeral there, I said to people, this is a very important concept about where heaven is, because everybody at that funeral wanted to know where Jerry was, especially her family. Well, we know she's in heaven. But the problem is, where is heaven? Where do you think heaven is? Where is heaven? How many are going to die and go there? Quite a few. Well, don't you care where it is? Well, that's true. I can't gainsay that. But where is Jesus? He's in the New Jerusalem. Well, where is that? Paul says it's above us. Paul says the New Jerusalem which is above. But the point is, how far above? I can remember some years back, there was a preacher that had a church, and every week he had a prophetic theme. Well, he had a lot of people there, and he would stimulate discussion by various things that he did. One of them was, he said that the scientists on Mount Palomar were looking, and they had seen heaven coming a long way off. Well, everybody went to church that Sunday because they want to hear about Palomar. Well, now, is that where heaven is? Is out beyond the blue? Where is heaven anyway? I've never been there. What I teach and what I believe is that the two are in the same place. And that's why there's only one word for them. That where the sky is, that is where heaven is. Well, how come we can't see it? Because it's spiritual, but if that's where it is. Our Father who is in heaven, you don't look down, you look up. Our Father's in heaven, but the Chinaman on the other side of the globe, he looks in the opposite direction. When he's looking up, he's looking down that way. So it's not related to direction as we think of, or to distance as we think of. It's spiritual. But it's not way out. So if you got in a rocket ship and went and was going at the speed of light, and you travel so many trillion light years, that eventually you get to heaven. No, it's probably where God the Father is, and Jesus is not much past the clouds. Now think of that. Not much past the clouds. Well, I don't know, but anyway, it says the heaven, the sky and the earth that we know are going to pass away. So he says, I saw a new heaven. That is a new sky. I believe that's what it means there in Revelation 21. I saw a new sky and a new earth. For the first sky and the first earth were passed away. I don't think this is the spiritual heaven. And there was no more sea. That is, there's no more multitude of people that are just tossed around like there are today, nations that don't know anything about the Lord. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. I was thinking as we were singing tonight, for his name is exalted. I know the church, I watch you while you sing that. Everybody loves that. There's such an anointing on that song. When we were in Jerusalem and heard that and saw the dancing men and the dancing women, and we were in the city of Jerusalem itself and heard that song, it's indescribable. It's worth the money to get over there. Let's put it that way. I know a lot in the church are too broke, you can't go over. But someday pray that, because it just is just like when we sing it here, only it's about 20 times greater. And I was thinking, if it's that great in the city of Jerusalem today, what is it going to be like when we're singing in the New Jerusalem? Oh, to see the dancing men and the dancing women and Jesus, and to feel that glory of God and to be in the Jerusalem of God, that's going to be wonderful. All right, now it said, now what is the holy city, the New Jerusalem? What is it? It's the church. Is it a city? Well, I rather think that it is, but there's no question in my mind that by the things that God said about it, he is talking about what he wants to be true of his church. This may be a real city. I would not say that it is not. My guess is that it's probably a real city that you can see. But somehow, this city is the church. And the things that it tells about it, God is not interested in rubies and diamonds and all those things. What do they mean to us in the spiritual realm? When Rob Wish saw his wife in a vision, he saw what bandaged his heart. And he didn't see any diamonds. Did he want to see diamonds? Here is a young man with his heart broken. Did he want to see diamonds and rubies? What did he want to see? His wife. Relationships. That's what heaven is. So I know when God spends this much time talking about gold and precious stones, then he's not taught, because that is not where it is. That is, we think that's where it is, but that isn't what we want. What he saw was his wife. Now, supposing he saw his wife and she was solid gold. I mean, That's nothing what we care about. Or she was walking on a street of gold. He wouldn't care what she was walking on. What does he care? It could have been a dirt path. As it was a meadow. He didn't say, oh, I'm so disappointed because I want her to have gold rings on her hands and a gold crown on her head and gold under her feet. No, I know that God is not telling us any such short-sighted thing as that by this city. He's talking about people and their virtues that he has created in them. He saw his wife, that's just all he cared about seeing, was Jerry. And she was running through a meadow, and then she was leaping from hill to hill. And then she talked to him in the vision. That's what he wanted to see. He didn't care anything about gold. So I know that God is telling us here is a vision. Now, the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, it is prepared. It has to be prepared. It has to be prepared. We have had in our doctrine of grace the concept that God sees us in Jesus. God sees us in Jesus. What does that mean to you? God sees us in Jesus. What does that mean to you? Right. Does he see us? In the current doctrine, does the Lord see us? No, he sees his son. How many have ever heard that preached? Okay, well that's basically what is preached. That makes you feel pretty good because you think, well, here I am, I know I'm a mess, but it doesn't matter because God sees me in Jesus. Now, is that true or not?
Yes.
Herb has got it. Yes and no. That's you can't lose. All right. Now, does God see us in Jesus? All right. Now let's take let's say that God comes down on a church. Paul was talking about some of the problems us older people have. You know, people this problem, that problem. All right. Now, does God see these problems? Does he see the backbiting? Does he see the lust? Does he see the things that we do? Or when he sees you and me, does he only see Jesus? Which is true? Huh? Esther, what about it? Is it true or not? Where's it going? Huh? Does he see us or not? All right, another winner over here. God sees everything. That's true. All right. Now, the thing is that when we come to Jesus and we are a liar and malicious and whatever, all the things that all of us have been, when we come to Jesus, the Lord throws out his robe of righteousness over us and he covers us and he says, Father, they are righteous. And so when God sees us, he remembers the words of his son and he sees us as being righteous in Jesus. Now that is what is preached today, and that is true, but the problem is there are conditions concerning that. That it's true under certain conditions, and because the conditions are not preached, it becomes a lie. You see, it's destructive because the person says, well, boy, you know, I just can't make it. I'm weak, and that's all there is to it, and I sin, and I know it, but God sees me in Jesus. So what we have to hear is the whole gospel. Now let's extend this to the New Jerusalem. Now, if we're in the New Jerusalem and we are the same as we are and not changed, all right, God looks down on the New Jerusalem and he sees us in Jesus, so he sees a perfect holy city. But now here's my question. All right, God sees us perfect in Jesus, we'll say. But how do we see each other? We see each other as we are. Doesn't God see us perfect today? But how do we see one another? Do we see one another through the eyes of God, or do we see them differently? We see everybody's faults like we're looking through a 10-power magnifying glass. I mean, we see not only the obvious faults, but we go around seeing those things that are so small, nobody would notice them, but we see them. That's because the devil is in there always picking fault with the saints and is quick to magnify that sort of thing. All right, now, if we're in the New Jerusalem and God sees us perfect in Jesus, but we see one another as we are, what kind of a city do you have? What kind of a city do you have? Well, it's no different than it is today. And I don't want to be there. How about you? I'll be alone. I don't want to be organized. I don't want to be ruled. I just want to be alone. I don't even want to pay taxes. I just want to be left alone. I don't want to get back into what we're coming out of. All right, now, if that's the case, if it's true, then what are we going to say about it? When do we change from what we are that God hides in Jesus? When do we be... Would you say that in this New Jerusalem, that this city is made up of people who are actually holy? Somehow they have changed what we are today until it actually is a holy city? Or is it a holy city only as God sees it? Which? The holy city the way we see it. Well, everybody sees it. All right, now, when do we change?
We get saved. Stuff has changed.
All right, that's exactly right. And that's what we talked about this morning, that God brings us through these changes that change us from the world, from sin, and from self-will, right? All right, now, if that's the case, what is it that's going on? We said these people that are raised here, are they actually changed, or does God just see them righteous in Jesus? All right, then, that's the whole concept. What God is raising here is a first fruits. A first fruits, so that through the first fruits, there will come the power and the grace and the wisdom and the ministry to make the change in the rest of the elect, in the rest of the body of the Messiah. Because you never see the holy city until the end of the millennium. It never appears here. All that appears at the beginning is a first fruits. That's all that appears. You'll never see the holy city until the end of the millennium. You don't see it here. All you see here is the bride in white raiment. But there is no city. So if there's no city there, and there is a city here, then we assume, and we can only assume it doesn't say so, except that Jesus alluded to it when he said, I'll walk the first day and the second day, referring to the 2,000 years here, and the third day I shall be perfected, giving us, and also a lot of verses in Isaiah, he will gently lead those that are with young, he will deal with the bruised reed and the weak, and a little one shall become a strong nation, that gives us the idea that during this period, the rest of the church will be made holy. So, if God has called you to be in this first resurrection, you cannot compare yourself with anyone else. You cannot do it. It means that God has called you to be changed, to be the beginning of the holy city. And remember, we said this morning that God does not judge us on the basis of the, in this terms what you're speaking, in the basis of the world or sin or self-will. But what does he, and people who are not here this morning will not understand me at all. But what basis does he judge us on?
Our response.
So you cannot say, well, okay, I see the deal. If I don't make it here, there's no matter, because by the time the Lord finishes with me, I'll be perfect. Because what is wrong with that reasoning? What is wrong? A person could very well say, I don't care about being raised here. I don't care about being a first fruits. If other people are ahead of me, that doesn't matter. I don't care about it. I'll just go ahead and then I'll take my chances that God will finish me up and I'm a weak sister and God will build on me during the millennium and so on and I'll be all right by the end, I'll be part of the city. What's wrong with that reasoning? See, we're making an assumption. We're making an assumption. And that assumption is that if I am careless now, that at some future point I will be diligent. And you people know that you have experience of life, and you know that that is not a sound way to proceed. How many have found out when you put off a difficult thing, does it get easier? What happens? It gets harder the longer you go. And when you're up against something that ought to be done, and you go saying, well, I'll face that down the road somewhere, how many know that you never get there? Because every time it comes up, you push it over. Every time it comes up, you push it over. Now, God comes to every human being at a certain point in his life. And he presents that individual with the choices to follow God or not to. And you and I have that choice today. God is calling us. He is not requiring of you and me that we drive sin out of ourselves, or that we be perfect, or that Christ come to maturity. God is not requiring that of you and me. Why? This is very important to understand. Why? Because He is the only one who can do that. He is the only one who can cleanse us from sin. He is the only one who can break the self-will in us. He is the only one who has the power to make us like Jesus. Is that right? Alright, so God is not going to hold us responsible for something that only He can do. So what is God holding us responsible for? Obedience. Doing the thing that He says to do day by day. These great changes in us, these transformations, only God can do. You cannot make yourself holy by your own efforts. You cannot make yourself in the image of Jesus by your own efforts. But what you can do is to obey God for the day. Now, you'll have choices to make tomorrow. You can go all day tomorrow without serious prayer, if you so choose. You can justify your use of time easily. This has to be done, Lord. And that has to be done, Lord. And you know this has to be done. And the rug has to be vacuumed. And I have to do this. It's easy to justify going through tomorrow without serious prayer. If you do, it begins to work. It's very insidious. It doesn't work all at once. But right now, in this period of time, we are in a dispensation of time. Right now, we are in a dispensation of time. And during this period of time, certain things are possible that will have never been possible before, to the extent that they are now, and I'm pretty sure never will be possible again in just the same way. And God doesn't crack down on you, you know, like this, if you miss today, bang, that's it. But over this period in your life and my life, right at this time when there's a lull before the storm, militarily and fiscally and other ways in our nation, right in this lull before the storm, we are hearing from God that God wants us to pay attention to the ministry of deliverance and of cross-carrying obedience. He wants this consecration now. He is more than willing to give us every grace, every spirit, every opportunity to lay hold on our personal development and our ministry as well, to seek Him and to do His will. This opportunity, when it is over, God's there will be a shift in the spiritual realm, and you will feel it, and it will no longer be possible. Now, I know I've been a Christian now nearly 41 years, and I know how things shift in the spiritual realm. Things are possible at certain times that are not possible at other times. It's like God opens a door in the spiritual realm. And what is possible today is to get yourself and your family so consolidated that you'll be able to go through with God's holy remnant in the days to come. But if you do not use this time, it's a window, to use a military term, it's a window. And during this period of time, you can go through to the full vision of God. But when that window is closed, you will see it will be different in prayer. Things will be different. So you cannot say, well, I don't care particularly about this resurrection because the other isn't so hard of making. That is not the way God judges. God judges in terms of our response to what is available. He doesn't judge us in terms of the deliverance. The deliverance, if we don't have deliverance, we die. If we do have it, we live. But God doesn't judge us on those terms. And that's just a consequence. If you remain bound, you abide in death. That's a consequence. The judgment comes on what you did. Did you read your Bible? Did you attend with the saints? When the Lord showed you something, did you confess it? Did you allow the television, as you heard tonight, is a lie? Even on the news we're being lied to. And in all the plays that we see, there is a lie in that it's not a true portrayal of people. It's the way the devil wants us to behave. But we get the impression this is the way that people behave. Everybody's smoking, everybody's drinking, there's sex before marriage. I mean, this is common, you know. The polls are showing it. The polls are not showing it. That's why we're being lied to. The thing is to convince us that this is what everybody's doing. And we can allow ourselves in this day to be lied to and to be changed, or we can come out and seek God and refuse to be moved by our generation. And that's what God will judge us on, because every one of us can do that. Every one of us can do that. We can't deliver ourselves. We can't be a great Christian. We can't have a ministry of healing. There's none of these things we can do. Only God can do that. We can pray, but only God can do it. But what God will hold you and me responsible for is how we spend every day that is left to us in this quiet before the storm. The way we spend our days. If we allow ourselves to be deluded and say, well, you know, the prophets are all hollering doom, but today is sunny and it looks like the summer's going to be the same. Let me plan. Shall we go up to the cabin and shall we do this? Listen, I'm not against vacation. You have to do what is healthy. But all I can do is sound the alarm. We're in desperate days. I cannot judge your life. I cannot judge what you are doing, whether it is diligent or not, whether you're redeeming the time or not. You and God are the only ones that know. But I tell you in the name of Jesus, the Lord, the Messiah, the Son of God, that if you let the oil run out of your lamp, you cannot buy in that day. You cannot buy in that day. It doesn't burn up all at once. It's as your lamp, as time goes on, and you're not renewing that oil and keeping oil, you don't see the effects of it right away. But when the midnight hour comes, and you say, oh, I got to do something about that, and it'll be too late. And that's what Jesus told us. Okay, now we said, do you see how they were judged there? They weren't judged on sin. They weren't judged on self-will. They weren't judged on worldliness. What were they judged on? What were those virgins judged on? They were, what did it say they were? There were five wise and five foolish. Did they have it in their power to act wisely? Yes, they had it in their power, and that's why God judged them. God doesn't come down on us because we're not like Jesus, because that's our cry. Oh, if I could be like Jesus. So it would be insult added to injury, wouldn't it? If God said, you're not like Jesus, everyone, bam, 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 bam. You're not like Jesus. We know it. God be merciful to us. We know that, see. So that God isn't going to judge us. What he says is, how did you use your time? See, did you redeem the time? That's in the power of your hand to do. To be like Jesus is not in the power of your hand to do. But to take the biblical steps of Christian service and living is in your power to do. And that's what he judges. Let's go to the man with the talents. What are you talking about? I thought you were in Revelation 21. I'm talking about this phrase that says, a bride adorned, coming up prepared. I'm talking about the word prepared in Revelation 21:2. There has to be a preparation. This city is prepared. It's not a city by grace. It's a city by preparation. All right, let's take the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. There's three great bases of judgment in Matthew 25. Three great bases of judgment. One, the oil. Two, the talents. Three, the cup of cold water. So we're talking now about the preparation. We're talking about that second basis of judgment. Now, there were these people, and they had been given talents. That was a Roman currency. So in our day, it would say money. They were given money. Okay, they were given different amounts of money. $10,000, $5,000, $1,000. All right. Now, on what basis did Jesus judge them? Did he deal with them there about worldliness? No. See, there's no judgment on worldliness. Jesus did that on the cross. Did he judge them in terms of sin? No, they hadn't broken the moral law of God whatsoever. They hadn't lied. They hadn't stolen. They hadn't become drunk. They were not profane. They hadn't blasphemed God. Hadn't done a thing. They were not guilty of a break in the moral law. How about willful rebellion against God? The people with the talents. Well, God hadn't told them something to do that they had refused outright to do. He had entrusted them with talents. Now, from our ordinary standards, the way we judge people, here, some of them have put their money out and they've really gotten an investment. They've gotten a return on it. All right, but this one person, they were a timid person. He said, I was afraid and I buried my talent and I have it. He wasn't dishonest. He said, here it is. I wrapped it in a napkin. He was a very careful, conscientious type of person. And he said, I've kept it clean and shiny and bright. And he held it out, you know, expecting the Lord to reward him for his dutiful return of what had been entrusted to him. All he had done was, he's a fussy and timid kind of person, and he was afraid if he put it out, he'd lose it. He wanted to give it back to the Lord. Now, what was the Lord's response? What did the Lord say to them? What did he call him? Wicked. Wicked. He said, that's an act of wickedness and laziness. So the Lord runs wickedness and laziness together. Now let me ask you a question. Was it in that man's power to do the Lord's expectation? Sure it was. All the Lord wanted him to do was go down there and trade with that money. To take that investment that the Lord had made in him and put it to work, which you can apply to your talent, your life, whatever opportunity you're given, that's your talent. Whatever God has given you, that's your talent. And you wouldn't expect the Lord to be that hard. Which, I'm just a timid soul, Lord, and all I did is I buried it, and here it is, and it's all shiny, and I'm just not courageous like those other people are. And we'd expect the Lord to have sympathy and mercy on poor little us. But there's something in God's nature that he does not go for that at all. He does not go for that attitude. And he said, you wicked and lazy servant. Because it was something that he could do. And he didn't do it. And God was thinking, I could have given this talent to another person and he'd have gotten five back for it. And this guy didn't do a thing with what I gave him. Now we need to be warned about that, because God does not view evil as we do in every case. See, we say, what's really wicked? Well, we start off probably with murder and then go to stealing. But the Lord said, not using your talent. And what was his sentence? What was the sentence of the five foolish virgins? What was their sentence? Yes. Yes. I spoke about that at the funeral too. It was something that the Lord gave me at the time. When we die on earth, there's a separation between man and wife. But there's no tragedy. It's temporary. Because you're going to see your loved one again. It's just a brief time when you're separated from a loved one, isn't that so? They're going to be raised. They're going to be raised flesh and bone. They haven't gone anywhere. They're just right above us, and they'll be back and be raised by the Lord. So there's no tragedy there if God takes someone. There's no tragedy unless it could have been prevented if someone disobeyed God, and as a result, God had to act in anger. Then there's a tragedy. But ordinarily, no, there's not that tragedy in physical death. We feel so terrible because we feel that awful wrench, because that is torn out of our heart, that relationship. It isn't that the person that died, they're in no pain. It's us because of the separation. But when you talk about those virgins being separated, see, you've got a tragedy there. Or where two are in one bed and one's taken, the other left. You've got tragedy there. Or two were in the field and one's taken the other. You've got tragedy there, because that's not the temporary separation of physical death. That is a permanent spiritual separation based on character. And there's tragedy there. There's tragedy there. Because that means that God has said, you don't belong in the same spiritual place with this person. I'm going to separate you. You've got tragedy there. Physical death is not a tragedy. Spiritual death is a tremendous tragedy. So if you have love for your loved ones and you really want to show love and concern, then you pray they'll be in the same spiritual place with you. That's what Jesus meant when he said that where I am, there you may be also. He wasn't talking geographically. He meant in the spiritual realm, at that spiritual level. If you want to avert tragedy, you pray like mad. If you have a loved one and they're really serving the Lord and you are not, then you are courting tragedy, because in the day of the Lord they'll be taken and you won't. And that's not a temporary separation. That's a separation based on spiritual realities. You are not at their spiritual level. So we need to think about that. So, all right, the virgins were separated. That was their punishment, was that they could not go in with their friends there, and especially with the Lord, to the marriage supper. All right, what was the punishment of the man who had wasted his talents? He was put into the outer darkness. What is that? What is the outer darkness? Well, it's a place where there's no light. I don't know, I've never been there. Before, when I read about it, the people who have been or reported or visions and so on, it seems that from a distance that you can see the light and the glory of the kingdom, but you're not permitted to enter. And the worse your condition is, the further out in the realms. And as you get away from God's kingdom of light, that you are walking on the earth, but you are in darkness. And some people have had visions of that. And you're walking around and the angels are there. The thing is, you just cannot approach the light. You can tell them the difference. And where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth is because your memory's intact. And you can remember, hey, I've got loved ones there. There's people that I love are in there, and there's light and glory and joy, and there's out here, there's nothing but darkness. And that's what Jesus said is the place where the people who do not use what God has given them will go into the outer darkness. Reality, people. Reality. Reality. What was the third judgment? The third judgment has to do with your attitude toward God's elect. Your attitude towards God's elect. if you feed them, if you clothe them. What do we see today? In Iran, 2 weeks ago, they announced, it was in the newspaper, they announced a poster contest for the children of the nation of Iran. It was announced by the government, a poster contest. Do you know what the subject of the poster contest was? How many know? Erase Israel from the earth. That is a poster contest for the boys and girls of Iran. It was last week, I think. There's a little article in the paper about it, announced by the Ayatollah Khomeini. Erase Israel from the earth. The Nazis tried to do that and they failed. We have people in our nation who are, they're called revisionists. They trying to revise history. There was no Holocaust, in spite of something like 6 million bits of data in the Yad Vashem there in Jerusalem. 6 million pieces of documentation. They're saying it never happened. It was a hoax put over by the Jewish people. Today in Russia, Paul was talking about the history of the millions that have been killed in Russia. I don't know, they have all these, they stage all these anti-this and anti-that. Why in the world don't they stage, the students in this country stage an uproar about the condition of the Jews in Russia? I mean, if you want to go where people really are being abused and beaten, not just don't have rights, but are being beaten and their families separated, it's the Jews in Russia. Well, why isn't that in the press, in the media? See how it's slanted? But that I told you about when we were over there and we saw the documentary film on it, that scientist and his son, and they took the scientist and they put him in a cage with some homosexuals who abused him and put him in a cage. Because he was a Jew. And then the secret police went to the school and worked up the kids against his son, young teenager, and they got him outside, a slight, slender fellow, and they abused him and hit him until they tore the brain stem loose in his head and his neck because he was Jewish. This is going on today. Why don't we have rallies about that on the college campuses? Why is that so strangely silent? If there's great hues and cries about political injustice, there has been since the days of the Magna Carta, since the French Revolution, and no doubt these are true and necessary. But I want to know, when a race of people is being tortured, why isn't something said about them? And I'll tell you why. Because of Satan. Because he hates them. Be careful. Of the days that are coming, there's going to be a persecution against God's elect, not only the Jews, but the Christians. And there's going to be a temptation to take the part of the world against them. And this is what God says to the nations concerning his elect, the brothers of Jesus. And when he said of that, and he was speaking to his brethren, of course they were all Jewish at that time, but now they're Jewish and Gentile, if we have become a part of Israel. If you want to get yourself into the kingdom that God has prepared, do good to Israel. Whether they're Jewish or Gentile, God's elect, Jesus' brothers, feed them, bless them, visit them in prison, take their part. Now the nations have had this opportunity down through the years. The United States is getting this opportunity right now. And so is England, and so is France, and so are the other Western nations. And the issue is oil. Now how does that work? The nations that are seeking to destroy God's chosen have control of the oil. So if the United States stands up for God's elect and Jerusalem, they stand in danger of an oil embargo which renders us militarily incompetent, and destroys our economy. You see how neat that is? You see what a beautiful trade-off that is? So in order to keep our standard of living, we have to help the enemies of God's people. And we're doing it. And I'm not a political preacher. I'm only preaching on this because of the three judgments, the things that God judges people for. First of all, foolishness. Foolishness, leading a foolish life, letting your oil run out for whatever reason. Can't see past the end of your nose. God takes no pleasure in that. Secondly, timidity, burying your talent. And the third great basis of judgment, your attitude toward God's elect. And the United States would be far better off to stand behind Israel and not to give one gram of help to any nation that is trying to obliterate Israel from the earth. Because if we do not, then God said, inasmuch as you did it not to the least of these, my brothers, you did it not to me. And to those nations who did not, he said, depart from me, ye cursed, into the fiery Gehenna. That's what God judges people on. First, their foolishness or wisdom. Secondly, their diligence with the things that have been given to them, the light that's been given to them. And thirdly, how we treat God's elect. Brother, sister, it wouldn't matter if the United States never had any more oil. Well, it would matter, but comparatively speaking, and the United States is right, has historically stood with the Jews, has historically stood with the Jews. And even today, we're trying to maneuver and make one of the bargaining chips, getting the Jews out of Russia, letting those that want to come out of Russia. But there's powerful political pressures on our nation. There's a lot of Arab money, and I'm not against the Arab. There's Arabs make just as good Christians as the Jews do, or anyone else does, and they are marvelous. In fact, Jan Willem there, the head of the Christian embassy there, the prophet of the embassy, they call him, his wife is an Arab. She's an Arab Christian, and his sons are in the Israeli army. They make just as good Christians. We're not here to say one single word about any race of people. We're talking about the nation that comes against God's elect. And according to Romans, God has not forgotten his people which he foreknew. And no matter how they live, God is the judge. And God says to bless them and to clothe them. And I'm sure that many of the people that hid the Jews in Holland and in other places are alive today because they stretch forth their hand to help the elect of God. Now I say this because I notice that in our country there is coming a spirit of anti-Semitism. There are people who are saying, well, maybe Hitler wasn't so bad after all. He was some kind of a thing that came out of the slime. He was a monster of monsters. And to have people say, well, maybe he wasn't so bad, is to show that we're back in one of these things where the Jews are going to go through and be tortured and be murdered and be imprisoned, while American Christians will do just like the German Christians did in the time of World War II. Well, it's all right because we're Gentiles and we're Christians, and maybe it's God's judgment on them because they murdered Christ. We've got to watch that. Because that's what the Lord is talking about as the third basis of judgment. I was in prison. That means any one of God's elect is in prison. And you visited me not is a basis that God judges. If you want to be blessed of God, do good to His people, His chosen people, whether they are Jews by race or whether they are Gentiles or Jews by spiritual calling, do good to the brethren of Messiah. And God will bring you into the kingdom prepared for the foundation of the world. Remember, at the end of the millennium, Over here, Satan goes out against the nations. And what do they go up against? Do you remember Revelation chapter 19? These nations are all right for 1,000 years, and finally Satan goes out to deceive him, and what does he have them do? Immediately. Where do they go? Revelation 19. Revelation 20, verse 8. And I want you to know, when you hear people talk about this revision in history, that there was no Holocaust, and when you hear people saying Hitler wasn't so bad, and when you hear say the Jews deserve it and all that, let me tell you who that is. That is Satan. Because he hates the Jews. He hates them. And he hates them because he knows that out from Jerusalem shall come his end. And he hates them. He knows that if he could destroy Israel from off the earth, the prophecy cannot be fulfilled. In fact, they have put a burial ground of people outside of the beautiful gate because they believe that Messiah will not go through the dead to go in through the beautiful gate where he's supposed to go to reign over the throne of David. So they've made it a cemetery so he won't pass through the dead bodies. That's a fact. It's a very unsightly thing. It's just a mess. You can stand on the Mount of Olives and see this beautiful gate, and then you're looking right at a cemetery in front of it so that Messiah can't go through there. Let me tell you something that happens when Messiah goes through there. Boy, the dead will get every which way, like this. And Messiah will go right through on a river of life, and that gate will just open up, and he'll go through, and he'll be anointed. When I was there, and I told you this, when we were there on the Dome of the Rock, and I was just walking along just like I had good sense, you know, staggering around, and all of a sudden, I knew whoever will rule the world is going to rule on that spot where the six of us, seven of us, whatever it was, were standing. I knew it. Don't ask me how. I don't know. I knew if Antichrist is going to rule the world, he's going to rule from there. I knew if Jesus is going to rule the world, whoever is going to rule the world is going to rule from that spot. You have to. That is the center of the rule of the world, is on top of that Dome of the Rock. And it's what Satan, what he has these kids doing through this Ayatollah Khomeini, and he can be saved like anybody else if he'll serve the Lord. But through this poster contest, erase Israel from the earth, that is Satan, because he knows that as long as there is a Jerusalem there and a throne of David, his throne is in jeopardy. So whenever you hear anybody running down the Jews or running down Christians, as you're going to hear in the future, against Christians or against anyone that God has called out, just say in your mind, Satan, because that's who it is. And right there, you'll make your choice. You're either going to be with the popular who are doing the accusing, or you are going to be with God's people who are taking the abuse. Clothe them. You know, there was a man... his name slips me now, but I think he was a black man, and he told Elijah, and he said, I hid the Lord's prophets when Ahab was after them. You remember that? And he hid them by 50s in a cave, and Elijah told him, by the name of the Lord, you get your life for a prey, because he visited God's elect. And here in Revelation verse 20, as soon as Satan goes out, he shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. Now that happens right here, after 1,000 years of rule. You say, how in the world could people be ruled for 1,000 years of righteousness and then be deceived into a rebellion against God? But they are, according to the Bible. Because people are people, and the devil is a master deceiver. And then verse 9, they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city. What is the beloved city? Jerusalem. See, even at the age, still he hates Jerusalem. He hates Jerusalem. From the time he stood Messiah up on the pinnacle of the temple and says, jump off. And he said, I'm not going to serve you. I will worship the Lord. I will not tempt God. From that moment, his kingdom was finished, and Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem. He rose from the dead in Jerusalem. right there in that rock tomb, and he's coming again to the Mount of Olives. He's going to rule in Jerusalem, and Satan knows that thing, and he hates it. Way worse than he hates America. He hates the Jews for that reason. So be careful. Don't get into this anti-Semitism. The Jews may be a despised people in the future once again. Take their side. Take their side. And when you see Christians being tortured, they may be some denomination that we're not. If you will clothe them and feed them and visit them, you will enter into the kingdom of God. If you do not, you will go into the fire. That's the third basis of judgment. Praise the Lord. There's coming down a new Jerusalem. And there's nothing Satan can do about it because God has already determined that it shall be. You will decide for yourself whether you are on the winning side or the losing side. But the Jerusalem will emerge as the city of the future. Praise the Lord.